Attention, attention, this is History Lost in Time.
And welcome to episode 28 of the History Lost in Time podcast. This should have been an aviation episode, but well, this is about aircraft carriers, and that's basically aviation as well. So here's an episode about both aviation and the Navy. And sorry if I sound a bit slurry, I am recovering from a tooth operation.
The topic of this episode.
I heard about these extraordinary ships by coincidence online, and I knew I had to talk about these. After all, these are the only coal-fired aircraft carriers ever to be in existence.
Political agenda and background.
None.
The sources that were used.
For once, I only have internet sources available. In this case, I am basing this episode on Wikipedia and a very good video by Drakinifil, which was published on March 24th, 2024 on YouTube. Even before the US entered the war in December 1941, it was obvious that the US Navy required a lot more naval pilots. However, the problem here is that only a part of the training can be done on land. In order for a pilot to be able to land on an aircraft carrier, he has to train by landing on an aircraft carrier. But as the US Navy did not have an abundance of carriers available, it was suggested to convert large ships on the Great Lakes near Chicago into aircraft carriers and do the training there. When the Japanese attacked the US at Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941, this suggestion was picked up and implemented as quickly as possible. Since the battleship fleet had been decimated in this attack, it was obvious that battleships would now only play a secondary role, and that all remaining carriers would have to remain in active combat roles. It would also take years for new carriers to become combat ready. Using one of the few remaining carriers solely for training was out of the question, so the Great Lakes idea made more and more sense. One shouldn't consider the Great Lakes to be calm inland lakes. One also gets quite severe storms there, and since the intrusion of enemy air and naval forces was basically impossible, the training carriers wouldn't require defensive weapons or escorts. Training could basically happen in peacetime conditions, while all US ships in the Atlantic, Pacific, and Caribbean had to be constantly on alert because of Japanese and German submarines. Additionally, there were already a number of US military bases on the coastline of the lakes, which made training and building up infrastructure easier. The US Navy had already gained some experience when it came to converting conventional ships into auxiliary aircraft carriers. This experience became really valuable now. The first ship that was converted was the CNB, a cruise ship that had been built in 1912. It was a paddle steamer that was still using coal as fuel. Its top speed was 19 knots. All of this meant that it wouldn't be an awesome aircraft carrier, but the ship was large and cheap since the owner really needed money, and that was enough. The CNB was converted between March and August 1942. She received a wooden flight deck, a typical island superstructure, and a mast for antennas. The flight deck was really wide, almost as wide as the flight deck of a fleet carrier, but it was only as long as that of an Independence-class light aircraft carrier. 8 cables, way more than usual, were installed to capture landing aircraft. On August 12, 1942, the ship was commissioned as the USS Wolverine IX-64. At that time, it was already clear that a second training carrier would be required, as one ship couldn't fulfill the needs of the Navy when it came to pilot training. So the Greater Buffalo, a ship built in 1924, was also bought and converted. In contrast to the Wolverine, she received a modern steel flight deck. She was commissioned in May 1943 as the USS Sable IX-81. The ships were quite similar otherwise. They displaced 6,500 respectively 7,300 tons and had a length of 150 to 160 meters. Their top speed was 18 to 19 knots. That meant they were too slow to operate when there was no wind. so on days without any wind, the pilots exchanged their combat aircraft for slow T-6 Texan trainer aircraft. These could start and land on the carriers under these conditions. That aside, the ships were active every day of the week, and for years, Lake Michigan was buzzing from the sounds of the engines of F-4F Wildcats, F-6F Hellcats, F-4U Corsairs, TBM Avengers, and SBD Dauntlesses. In time, the US Navy also started training carrier deck crews and British Fleet Air Arm pilots on these ships. And one of the US pilots that received his carrier certification on USS Sable was future US President George H.W. Bush. Of course, there were lots of accidents and problems. At the bottom of Lake Michigan, up to 250 aircraft are known to exist, which were lost during the training flights or so badly damaged that they were abandoned and thrown overboard. The fact that these were coal-fired ships caused some problems initially, as the combination coal-fired and aircraft carrier was an unknown at the time. The heavy smoke made it difficult for pilots to land. However, in time, the crews gained experience, which allowed them to manage these issues and to make life easier for the pilots and for themselves. The fact that these were paddle steamers didn't cause any problems. On the contrary, this meant that the flight decks could be really wide. Since the ships had no hangars, the flight decks were really low, which increased the stability of the ships. The aircraft were stationed on land and only came aboard during the day for landings and takeoffs. There were no lifts aboard, so work on the aircraft could only happen on deck. More than 17,000 pilots were trained aboard these two carriers. Way more than 100,000 landings happened on these ships. Both ships received the American Campaign Medal and the World War II Victory Medal, despite being unarmed and having seen no combat missions. However, their work allowed the combat vessels to focus on combat missions, and they provided the US Navy, probably also the US Marine Corps, and the Fleet Air Arm with an enormous amount of qualified pilots. At the end of the war, the US Navy had more carriers than it needed, so future training could take place on actual warships. Both coal carriers were therefore decommissioned in November 1945. Converting them back into civilian ships was not economically feasible, and keeping them as museum ships was never seriously considered. So they were both scrapped in 1947 and 48.
A few finishing words.
Both the USS Wolverine and the USS Sable impressively demonstrate, with their history, how effective good enough can be. Of course, it would have been more elegant to use a proper Essex-class carrier for training. Then one could also have trained aircraft carrier crews. One wouldn't have to learn the peculiarities of these ships. And there are probably more reasons. However, the Wolverine and the Sable were available quickly, they didn't cost much, and they did the job they needed to do, train carrier pilots. When you look at modern weapons projects, one can get the impression that the goal is always something that we in Germany call the eierlegende Wollmilchsau, the egg-laying wool milk pig, a combination of chickens, sheep, cows and pigs. The weapon systems are supposed to perform multiple missions, and the promise is always that costs are reduced because of synergy effects. But it seems like every time what you actually get is a weapon system that ends up being over budget, delayed, and not actually capable of doing everything it was promised to do. More weapon systems that are optimized for a single mission profile, meaning systems that are good enough and not ideal, could be the better choice when it comes to time and costs. The best weapon systems were always those that were optimized for a single purpose and turned out to be good at other things too, with time and some modifications. But well, maybe that's just my own opinion on this.
Thank you. This was History Lost in Time.